And welcome back to the Ushers of Horror.
Welcome back.
Hello, hello.
How is everybody doing?
Yeah, good.
Very well. Very well rested.
Beautiful. Ah, that's perfect. That's what, oh, yeah, a nice little nap beforehand. That's
all that was. Yeah, which I never do. I did today because I was just like, you know, I've got to be ready for this for this episode. Well rested.
I also see a new face as well. Who's that?
Hello, hello, hello.
Who's that hiding there in the corner? Come out.
Hi guys, nice to be here on Ushers of Horror. It's a great privilege to join you guys for today's episode.
Welcome, welcome.
Long time listener, first time caller.
One of
raw
us.
Time.
One of us.
Raw time.
Raw time. Raw time. Raw time.
Do you want to introduce yourself? Some people might know you.
So my name is Ed. I know Paolo, obviously, from uni. Yes, from way back when. And we are both big horror fans. That was actually probably one of the first things that we sort of bonded over at uni.
Aww.
So when he said he was doing a horror podcast, I said I was very keen to join sometime. And here I am.
There you are. We've made it work. So how did you get into horror?
So I never used to like horror films. The idea, when I was of a kid growing up, the idea of horror films was just too much for me to handle. Even like the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode.
Yes.
Hello, boils and ghouls. I am the Crypt Keeper. Or should I say, master of scaremonies.
Would just absolutely scare, I mean, that was my introduction to horror, but they absolutely terrified me. I think they sort of intrigued me at the same time, but they totally scared the shit out of me. So I didn't really watch horror films for a long time. I sort of really, again, perhaps, probably got into them properly at uni, sort of watching horror films with you. And since then have just, you know, developed a deep fondness for the genre. It's become my favourite film genre. And yeah, I'm just now a total horror nut.
It's healthy. Sounds healthy.
What are some of your faves?
My faves? I'd say, I think Paolo actually did ask me to think of a top three horror films for this. So I'll do my top three, which I came up with. The Shining would be number one. Shining is my all-time favourite movie.
Here's Johnny!
So that's definitely my top horror film. I just think it's a masterpiece. Second movie, I'm going to go Evil Dead.
Shut up!
I think I'm actually in the one of the people, probably the minority, who think the original Evil Dead is the superior movie.
We agree. Evil Dead 2.
I think you did mention this in one of your previous ones. Yeah, I think the consensus is often that
the second
Evil Dead 2 just improved on everything. But I think the first one has the perfect balance of horror and comedy, whereas Evil Dead 2, it gets a bit too slapstick, a bit too silly. At times for me, and I think the Evil Dead, it's funny, but it's also absolutely terrifying, you know, done on a small budget, just a bunch of friends making a movie together essentially, and then they made a classic.
And it's one of those films that if you don't know how to make a film, just watch The Evil Dead.
Exactly, yeah. And then number three, I'm gonna go Wreck, the Spanish found footage movie. Which I watched that with you, Paolo, when we were in second year, and I was, you know, the sort of cliche of you watching a movie behind your fingers, like covering your eyes. That's genuinely what I was doing in the last sort of 15 minutes of that movie, because it is just, it probably is, I'd say, the scariest film I ever
seen. I still haven't finished the series. There's four of them. I've seen the first three, and I still haven't seen
I've only
four.
Seen the first two, actually.
The first two.
I've never seen three
or
four.
The first two are great movies. The second one is very similar to the first one. Both great.
Mm.
Third one is no longer found footage. And so
I heard that.
Neither is the fourth. The third one setting a wedding, and the fourth one set on a boat.
It's on a boat, isn't it? Yeah. Because it's two brothers who, the first two were written, directed by two brothers, and then I think one of them went off. I think one of them did the third one, and then another one did the fourth one. I think they sort of
I bet
broke
they could,
off, but it clearly only works when it's both of them.
Creative control, probably some family feuds going on.
I bet, yeah, they sort of, the success went to their head. Maybe they fell out.
Especially
yeah.
being family, though, that's just a recipe for could get nasty.
Mm.
Fair, okay, it's quite a healthy dose of horror then. They're three, like, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard, you know, three favorite horror films is a hard, sure, hard to narrow down. There's yeah. a lot that I love. Yeah,
it's like picking your favorite child, I think.
Why do you yes. have children, Paolo?
My dog, actually.
Oh yeah, fair. They're kind of like children.
It's the closest thing. One day, but not yet. Well, we're getting quite deep on our horror podcast about kids and whatnot.
Yeah.
What, Conan? You were telling me yesterday about followers on Twitter and what have you.
Was I?
Was it you?
It must have been you. You're always talking about Twitter.
Yeah, like, I thought, weren't you saying like we got like some like 700 plus people on Twitter?
Yeah, we're like 700 plus now, trying to get to that 1,000. Maybe we'll get there soon.
We could do like a giveaway.
Inshallah.
Maybe, we get yeah,
1,000 follower gets like a button. Usher of Horror merchandise, yeah.
A t-shirt.
I would love an Usher of Horror shirt, t-shirt,
well,
yeah.
Well, maybe unfollow us and then refollow us on the 999 and then yeah. get
the
t-shirt.
Yeah. We should do a giveaway.
Yeah, that would
be know
fun.
Where
be fun.
You have to tag people and you all of that stuff. I see a lot of Instagram and let's get in on that action.
Yeah.
Would get a lot of traction,
I can make
yeah.
a horror rug and we can give that away.
Horror rug, yeah.
Ooh,
because
yeah, do it.
I've almost finished my rug and I'm just doing the edging on it today, so, you know, we can give one away.
I mean, yeah, that'd be fun. That'd be cool, actually. Rugs are very useful, especially...
So follow us on Twitter and Instagram and share us with your friends.
Yeah, you might be
or else
lucky enough to win something.
Some of you may die, but it's a sacrifice I am willing to make.
Do it.
Last episode, we did our first in reviewing sort of more modern movies. And I think we're carrying this on. Well, I know we are carrying this on this episode. Did you guys want to fill in the gaps and what we're covering today and whatnot?
So today we are going to review Saint Maud. And we have Ned with us today.
This is Ned Schneebly.
Actually, it's Schneeble.
Because this is one of your favourite films of the year, right?
It was, yeah. It was one of the few films I was actually fortunate enough to see in a cinema last year. I saw it in November, I think it was, yeah, one of the three films. I saw, I saw Tenet, The Lighthouse, and Saint Maud in the cinema last year, and I think there were three perfect films to actually see on a big screen. Saint Maud in particular, and yeah, it was definitely my favourite film of last year. I thought it was just one of these films that you watch and think it's almost, you know, it just all comes together. I thought it was pretty perfect, actually. I mean, a intense, arguably quite a difficult watch, but I mean, I still think it was a very powerful film, very effective film, and yeah, a lot to unpack with it as well. So I think it would be a very interesting discussion.
Cool.
Wow, there you are. That's quite the endorsement.
Ooh.
Well, well, as we always do, we'll play the trailer for you guys just so you can listen, and then I'll give you a quick introduction and we can jump right into it.
Sounds perfect.
Rated X.
Dear God, your presence graces the air, and soon everyone will see.
Hi, are you Maud?
Yes, hi. It takes nothing special to mop up after the dying.
You're prettier than the last one.
But to save a soul, that's quite something. Bless Amanda's body, and bless her mind, which is shrouded in darkness.
When you pray, do you get a response?
Oh, it's like he's physically in me. It's how he guides me.
My little savior.
Hey, I thought that was you.
What are you up to?
I'm a private carer. You're still nursing?
What?
And they know what happened.
All the good girls go to hell. Cause even God herself.
I just want to see you loosen up.
I've got more important things on my mind.
There's my little saint.
Maud, he isn't real.
Nothing worthwhile comes easily.
All the good girls go to hell. Don't say I didn't want you.
You must be the loneliest girl I've ever seen.
I'm ready and open. And I feel fuller of your love than ever before.
I have a responsibility.
Oh yes, of course.
This is life and death on another level.
If I'm getting it all wrong.
All the good girls go to hell.
And that was the trailer for Saint Maud, a British psychological horror film, and a debut feature film by British director Rose Glass. The story follows a hospice nurse, known as Maud, a recent convert to Roman Catholicism who becomes obsessed with a former dancer in her care, believing she must save her soul. Originally released at the Toronto International Film Festival in September 2019, it was then released in the United Kingdom for a wider release in October 2020 by Studio Canal UK and in America by A24. So without that, who wants to start?
Let's start with the special guest. It's his favourite film.
Go for it.
Okay. I think there is, like I said earlier, a lot to unpack about this film. I'd say first and foremost, it is a character study of our title character, Maud, as she is going by at the point we see her in the film. Obviously, like you say, she's a hospice nurse. At the start of the film, begins with her in a hospital. We don't see exactly what's happened. There is a dead patient there. Maud looks at the ceiling and she sees a cockroach. And this, I felt this was the beginning of her relationship with God, which is obviously what the film is essentially about, is Maud's, the fact that Maud has since working at this, hospital and gone, and since she's gone to private caring, she's become a devout, Christian. It's really, God is the most important thing in her life. And after she starts taking care, starts caring for Amanda, who is a sort of faded actress and singer who Maud sees as almost the embodiment of sin initially. You know, she drinks, she smokes, she has multiple sexual partners, and Maud decides that it is her mission from God to save Amanda's soul, and this is now her purpose. So I think, yeah, religion obviously is first and foremost of this film, and I felt the dangers of religion, the dangers of putting, sort of obsessing and putting yourself into just one single thing, and about sort of isolation and loneliness as well. But yes, what do you guys think? Sort of, what was your takeaway from this?
But I loved it. I watched it fresh last night and I was just like, wow. I didn't read anything too much about it. I just knew I try not to do that with films because otherwise I have too many expectations. And I think this one really blew my mind. The fact that it was directed by a woman and it was about like the female's experience. And for me, it was like you see the entire film through one perspective, which is Maud's perspective and nobody else's. So you experience everything she does and you don't see it from any other side. And I think Ross did, is it Ross? What's her name again? Maria?
It's like Rose?
Rose Glass.
I accidentally called her something else. Oops, my bad. Rose Glass. She did that really, really well, I think. Yeah, I thought it was dope. I wanna talk about the juicy meaty stuff and get into the spoilers, but I have to wait for that. So yeah. I'm gonna let Kozan or Paolo take the next bit.
Yeah, I thought it was really great. I thought I really loved it. I thought it was, like you were saying, it's hard to talk about the film without ruining it. But there's a lot of like atmosphere. The film just keeps pumping the atmosphere up to, yes, like, you know, it's like a pressure cooker. And there's a lot of, again, like symbolism, a lot of like religious symbolism in it. But
there's a lot, yeah.
But it never feels, you know, try hard. You know what I mean? You know, some movies, like, you know, what was the one with Gabriel Byrne? Stigma, a good film, but it kind of did feel like a 90s industrial music video. This dealt with really heady themes in a really down to earth but serious way, I thought. Almost like, you know, Bergman's Through a Glass Darkly meets maybe The Exorcist or something. Yeah, really powerful, dark, sad filmmaking.
Do you know what? I think that's probably because the director, when she first started to make the film, she didn't necessarily even intend to make it a horror. It just sort of turned into that because of the, that, like, yeah, through the experiences of the character Maud, like how everyday horror sort of plays into everybody's lives. I think
it's ended up being not, like that. Like, large portions of it aren't even really a horror film. It's like the horror would just, it will, you know, things will be happening quite normally, and then out of nowhere, it would just, a ridiculously scary scene or something really creepy happens, and then it will go completely back to normal. It's like the horror is sort of sprinkled throughout very effectively because it's sort of adjacent to all this normal everyday
but
stuff.
I find that it works so well because Maud is kind of a creepy character. She's always on edge. Yeah. She's just like a bit anxious.
She's completely obsessed with Amanda in a very unhealthy way.
A bit like obsessive in a way where it's just like, I will save her. I'm the savior, which is, I think, I'm not saying that loads of religious people have that, but I think some religious people think that they, what they believe in is like the best thing in the world, and they, because it saved them, it can save you. And she's obviously been through something really traumatic, and she thinks, oh, because this made me see things differently, maybe it can help you. But really, Maud, I don't think the religion's helping you, babes. I think it's got to your head. I think that's what the film's about.
I think religion is almost a red herring in this movie. I don't think the theme is really about theology at all. Maud's character is very similar to Robert De Niro's character in Taxi Driver.
Yes.
It's an interesting comparison.
Travis Bickle.
They both
are really neurotic anti-heroes who have their own super important mission statement, and the rest of society don't even know who they are, but they think they're trying to either save the world or save someone, and they're really just, they don't care about whatever anyone else has to say.
Everything they say
focused.
Is true to themselves, yeah, and they believe everything to be true, yeah. But like you said, I think where Robert De Niro does it in Taxi Driver, he uses like the political campaign to justify his reasons to do what he does. And in this film, Maud uses
religious
justification to do like back up her actions. And even though you're right, I don't think religion is the main theme, even though it's like a big theme in this, it's not, you're right, I don't think it is a bit of a red herring, and there's like a lot of other layers to look at.
I think the religious aspect is used as almost like the it's just her obsession. The same thing with Travis Bickle, their sort of blinded obsession has led them down this rabbit hole where they've kind of become like an outcast by the end of it. You know, throughout the film, like you were saying earlier, Alex, about you know, it's kind of done from her point of view. There's a scene which I'm not going to spoil, but she's looking over to try and interact with people, and she physically like pushes them away or like turns her body language away, and it's how, you know, this one track mind would just has led someone down such a heartbreaking path, much like when we did on His House, the idea, you know, people falling through the fishing net, you know, because I think Maud definitely has, because when she's having a certain like fits and what have you, I do think she might have suffered from some form of schizophrenia or epilepsy. Or something, yeah. And I know there is like in real life study cases that a lot of people who suffer from schizophrenia do have some sort of obsessive nature. Sometimes it's really, sometimes you're saying with Travis Bickle, it's more of a political thing.
It's almost like there was a vacuum to be filled through her sort of obsession and isolation, really. There was something needed to fill that, and that became religion because she didn't know what else to do
with
it.
But also, I don't think that, like, it's completely up to Maud's character to like sort of fix herself or make herself better or anything like that. I think a lot in the film where she's in social interactions with other people, it's just like she might be trying to engage in her own way and other people might take that differently and everyone's trying to make me a little bit mean to her. Not mean, but a bit like look at her differently. Standoffish because you know, it doesn't matter if she is Christian or if she is a bit religious. Like that should be okay, but it shouldn't make you look at someone a bit weirdly and it's you see that through her lens that you see that she feels further isolated by everyone around her, even though she thinks she thinks she's trying to do something good.
She knows she wants to sort of participate, especially there's a section in the film where we'll discuss it more when we go into spoiler territory, but yeah, there's a obsession where she sort of goes out to the pub and tries to sort of make friends, and it's there's a bit where she sees some people laughing and she sort of tries to laugh with them and they sort of give her a funny look, and then and it's really, really sad. She's extremely lonely and isolated, but she doesn't really know how to sort of react with people and to connect with people.
I feel like we can all like definitely not maybe everybody, unless everyone's a social butterfly, but like everybody can like, you know, relate to the experience of like being in a social setting and not like knowing when to say something or being like, oh, am I included? Am I not? Should I even be here? Like it is awkward as well. And especially like you can't really go to the pub by yourself and then randomly join a conversation. Do you know what I mean?
Like the other character, Amanda tells her, she's a very Maud is a very lonely, lonely woman. And a lot of the film is about alienation from the world, from society. She's using religion as almost an escapism from that to 100%. Give meaning to her life. But obviously she takes it to a whole nother level that regular people wouldn't do.
It's like when you mix trauma and mental health with hardcore like religion. I think it's sometimes it can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. Where like I was saying, like in the same terms of like, do you know in Carrie where the mum is like some crazy super Christian Catholic, but she uses Christianity as a way to like abuse and sort of like. Rule the hand of God.
The justification for doing
everything
horrible things.
Like, oh, Carrie, you got your period because you've had dirty thoughts, but it's just like, actually, you dumb bitch. It's science. It's not like Jesus. No, it's not Satan trying to like give her a period because she's thought about sex. That's not what's happening. But it's like the confusion of all of that shit. I think it happens a lot in like religion.
I certainly think there's a lot of like sexual repression within Maud. Again, I will get onto it a bit later, but I certainly think she might be on somewhat the curious side with certain things.
I think there is a bit. Well, yes, I agree. There is a bit early on where Amanda asks Maud what it's like when she's communicating with God, and Maud replies by saying, "He is physically in me," and that I think is the one of the first sort of instances of this relationship she has with God. Almost does seem to be a sexual relationship. It's like he's her.
But that's
partner,
what God
almost.
Wants. No, Jesus was like, drink my blood, eat my body, you are my soul. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? He wants to be inside you. He wants that.
Well, the Holy Spirit is supposedly always around us.
Yeah, but that's
the
other
Trinity
thing I was going to say.
The Father,
yeah.
the Son, and the Holy Spirit. It's so like, she's talking about the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost.
Like the whole thing where she's like, the God is in everything. In low, even like small parts of the film where it looks really normal, there's like editing skills or something that's been done that you're like, yo, that's not right, or it looks a bit weird and you're like, is that God? Is that her hallucination? What's going on? And it's sort of like the play on the thing where it's just like God is in everything, God is one, God is all, but yeah, mixed in with her experience and what she's going through.
I think that's the thing, because it is told from her perspective. It's a classic sort of unreliable narrator story. We're seeing everything from her perspective and we're really not sure what we can trust, these sort of seemingly supernatural little subtle detail, like things that happen, which you could even miss if, you know, you're sort of half watching, you're left asking, is this happening or is this all just in her head from her perspective?
Well, she did say her influences for this movie, other than Ingmar Bergman and his,
Was Bergman actually an influence on it?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Through a Glass Darkly, The Silence.
Oh, the Faith trilogy.
The Winter Light, Faith trilogy. Yeah, but also
Persona as well. I'd say with the sort of relationship between the characters. Yeah, but also
I think he's stronger than all of that is Repulsion. Roman
Polanski. 100%. Yeah, she spoke about that in an interview. She gave the two actresses a list of films to watch, and Repulsion and a few of other Roman Polanski's films. She gave him a starter pack, like, here, watch all these films.
And the fact, and she even mentions Carnival of Souls, and like the whole fact that it's set in a seaside town had the same sort of tone as Carnival of Souls.
Yeah, I think she also tried to say that sort of like that she really likes those what are they called, pressure cooker dramas, where you're in one room and that's sort of like the tension that builds between two people in an isolated space, which obviously she made this film in 2019 pre Miss Rona, so you know it's even more like relatable. Like, you're in one house with someone, you can try to be friends with them, but you never know what's going to rub each other the wrong way. You might have different ideologies or beliefs, and it's just gonna like in those films, like dialogue and everything else has to be, it has just to be on another level. You can't rely on everything else. And even though,
well, she literally says at one point, doesn't she, it's life or death, it's on another level.
It's on another level.
It's another level. And the great thing, because it's delivered with such like self-belief. Like she, I forget the actress, she's a Swedish, isn't she?
Welsh. Morford Clark.
I'm glad you said it, because I wasn't
fantastic in this film.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Oh, she's absolutely brilliant. Yeah,
Morford.
Totally. And if she
she's really, really good.
Carry that. There isn't a scene in it where you don't believe this woman is, you know, just in every scene you can almost hear her own internalized thoughts.
Well, it is. She is the film, really. She, you know, she's in every frame of the movie. It's completely from her perspective, and she totally embodies. There's this sort of reserved, sort of, it's a very controlled performance. She's very reserved. You know, you totally feel her sort of isolation and her loneliness. Really, I think it really comes through in the performance.
Agreed. All of them across the board. Even what's her name? The lady
Amanda.
Jennifer Eel?
Yeah.
When I first saw her in the film, I thought it was Sigourney Weaver. I was like, "Yo, wait a minute."
No, she does. They do have a resemblance. True, definitely.
I didn't think about that.
You're not quite sure if she is, you're not quite sure if she's really, because obviously, when she discovers that Maud is very religious, she's intrigued by this, I think, initially. She's drawn to the religion as well, out of her fear of dying.
Yeah, which I think anyone near their deathbed, like, it's always a classic thing, you know, like, I'm dead, might as well try to see if God's good or not, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's partly what it is, because she's an atheist in the film, isn't she? Amanda.
Mm.
And that whole thing where, you know, she kind of considers it God's mission to try and save this woman's soul. But the way she's portrayed is, you know, you can't quite figure out who she is. Again, from Maud's perspective, because Maud is missing out on all these social cues when she's smirking at her. And then, you know, it kind of erupts.
Yeah.
Ooh, erupts.
Yes.
Ooh, erupts.
I want to say a cool fact about, why do I keep forgetting her name? I feel bad.
Who? Rose Glass?
Rose Glass.
Morford Clark? Yeah.
Rose Glass, she used to be an usher at Curzon Mayfair before she made this film.
Represent.
She's one of
she's one of
Google Gobble, you are one.
Well, exactly.
A fellow usher of horror.
Exactly.
You guys should try and get her on.
It's actually not a bad show. Is she on Twitter even?
Maybe.
I'd imagine so.
I'll give her a phone call later.
Or are you going to link her? Spell her line.
Yeah. Down the park.
Social distancing.
All socially distanced. All socially distanced.
Are we getting to the spoilers now? Because
warning: the rest of the episode contains spoilers for Saint Maud. If you have not seen the film, pause this episode now and go watch it. Thank you very much.
We'll get straight into it. What do you guys think of the ending and the last sort of 10 minutes?
Harrowing, horrible, great.
Oh my god! That I jump screamed. Scare. What that jumps? Oh, I. Don't think that might be the most effective jump scare I think I've ever
seen. Which one are you talking about?
The last one.
The one of her in the bed, or one of her on fire.
The last scene.
Now, which one were you talking about when you said that jump scare? Which one were you referring to?
Oh.
I meant the one where not the last bit, the one where Amanda is in bed and Maud is, she essentially ends up doubting her faith. Yeah. And then seemingly possessed by the devil, Amanda jumps up, sort of jumps at her in bed and her face distorts. Mm. That was the one I found to be
really effective. So good, because throughout the whole film there's like small distortions in Maud's face, like when she's like exhaling or like pulling her face and she's having these like bodily experiences. So when it happens to Amanda and her head stretches from like here to the fucking ceiling, you're like, what? Mm. Like, it came out of nowhere. You're like, what the fuck? It's terrifying.
I think it's just
it shows how weak her faith really was. She, each time she was challenged a bit, her faith went out the window.
Mm.
She slapped Amanda when
she
made a comment about God. She, after she lost her job, she went on the town, had sex with two different men in one night. And then again, she goes to see Amanda just as she's dying and she makes one comment and then blows up, sees her, Amanda as the devil incarnate.
Stabs her to death.
Murders
her.
She's a murderer. Yeah.
Her faith was incredibly weak in a way.
Like you say, it's not really about the religion. It's just this is something to give her life meaning, and it almost happens.
But she also uses it to justify some of. You're never really sure what happened before, but it's hinted that she had something to do with someone's death in a hospital by accidentally crushing.
Implied that she was giving CPR and the person died. The person looked like they were already dying.
Like when she was having sex with one of the guys from the pub that she just, you know, has a fling with, and she's on top of him and she's like doing whatever, she's riding him, she's got her hands on his chest, and then it flashes from her having sex to her having that moment when she pushes through this man's ribcage.
Too hard. Breaks,
PTSD. Exactly,
suffering this trauma.
Hashtag trauma.
Because it's set later on in the film, because like, it doesn't really dwell on, you don't find out the details of what happened, but later on, because there's the character obviously from her past in her nursing days, Joe, I think her name was, Joy, that's it. And she says to her near the end of the film, Maud, you were struggling. We all saw you were struggling and we didn't really do anything. Mm. Sorry. So you get the impression she was, even back in her old nursing days, she was still lonely. She was still isolated and people could have helped her and didn't. And then this incident that happens when she ends up killing a patient through CPR, it's something that you get the impression it could have been avoided if she had had people in her life to support her, and as a result she didn't, and spiraled more into her obsession with God.
The saddest thing about the film is that stuff, as soon as the film ended, my first thought was, God, that's really sad. Stuff like this happens all the time. The amount of people who are on the edge or are suffering from some form of trauma who just fall through the wayline and end up, you know, on really self-destructive paths. And that was what I really took out from this film. Right? It was just, again, you know, dealing with really heady, like, arguably metaphysical or not, really big themes, but done in such a grassroots sort of way.
It's sad because the director was saying in the interview, like, at any point during the film, if someone had asked her, like, hey, you're right, or, like, there were so many signals, not just going through her own experience, but everyone around Maud could have just stepped in and been like, are you actually okay? Like, is everything going fine? But it's everybody else's sort of like, you know, like Amanda's a hedonistic ex-glamour actress, musician or whatever she is. She's obsessed with herself and like everyone else is sort of in their own lives. And she's a person that lives alone. And it just shows when someone is isolated dealing with a trauma or dealing with something and there's not a support network around them, you can, like you said, really fall through the cracks and it can become so cathartic and insular and just a bit like, just like the end scene where she takes her own life by setting herself on fire, and you see, you first see her as envisioned as an angel, like she thinks everybody like around, she's like a martyr, she thinks everyone's gonna rate her for
Saint
it
Maud.
Mm.
Yeah,
exactly.
Saint Maud, exactly. Yeah. Did any of you, before the final frame, did any of you think, shit, maybe this is all real, maybe all this is true, and maybe she is now going to heaven?
No. I thought she needed help.
No.
Yeah. No point.
Because I think it's, I didn't think that, but I think before that last shot, it does keep things ambiguous, like a lot of it, especially sort of horror films in the recent years, like the Babadook or The Witch. Say it sort of leaves it. You know, there's that question: is all this happening, or is it all in their heads? And I like with St. Maud, it left you in absolutely no doubt that this is all completely in their heads.
That very last shot basically, I think, clarifies it.
I think that was very
important.
Well,
maybe not. I think maybe she still thought that she was an angel when she was, but you know,
oh,
like,
she did throughout the whole
because
film
even
she
because
that.
The
oh,
whole yeah, Catholic yeah, yeah. thing of like self-inflicted pain where she puts needles in her
more
shoes and goes to town.
Yeah,
she's throughout the film. She is
exactly,
self-harming
so,
as well. You see these scratches on her stomach.
Her
well.
Setting herself on fire and maybe screaming, that. Even though to us it doesn't seem euphoric. To her experiencing that, it could still be, which is why we're showed the angel. Beaming of light first, and then for the first time I think in the film, which is like the last millisecond, we see it from an outsider's perspective, and I think that's the first time you see it not from her eyes.
Yeah,
which is
I agree,
the last
I think,
2 seconds
yeah.
of the film, I think.
Because there are points when there are overt supernatural. I think after the first time, that fairly early on in the film, Amanda calls Maud her savior. She said maybe mockingly. Maybe not, but Maud obviously doesn't see the irony if she is mocking her. And that's the point where she sort of walks outside and things start moving around and she appears to be sort of possessed by God. And later there's a moment where she actually levitates
that's right,
as well
that's right.
From her perspective.
Right. And then she actually talks to something.
She
was
talks.
To God,
she talks.
Believes?
She. Yeah, she's the cockroach again, which becomes a sort of... A symbol for religion. I thought this was very interesting having that the cockroach you know
but
as,
don't
as
you
your
think,
symbol for
you
religion.
Supposedly
like...
they wanted a moth, but there was no moths in season.
They couldn't CGI that stuff.
The producer came back with two cockroaches and
I'm gonna find you a moth, I have two cockroaches.
That's kind of mad.
That's much better.
I thought it was a nod to like Franz Kafka, like the Metamorphosis where she can't, there's a scene where she like can't get up and it's sort of like the bug is stopping her. It's all like this existential dread of like what she is and what people might see her as is like this cockroach. I don't know.
Cockroach.
The book Amanda gives her about religion. No. She gives her a book of William Blake paintings and I thought that was interesting because I was just like, he's a big painter in the religious painting side of stuff, like the dark history.
I think it is taking the piss. I think it's I did a little bit of sort of googling today about William Blake and how he depicts religion, and it's done in a sort of almost a sexually liberating kind of it's not the sort of reserved prim and proper sort of depictions of religion. It's, you know, almost like, you know, new depictions of God and stuff with a big sort of barrel chest and stuff. I think Amanda is sort of mocking her and sort of poking fun at how sexually repressed Maud is by giving her this book. And again, Maud is not in on the
and
joke
I think
at all.
She knows it because I do think there is some lesbian subtext in the film.
And oh, 100%.
No, Maud is the director specifically said that's a red herring.
Oh, it's a red herring.
Amanda thinks that mistakenly, but the. So Amanda's a lesbian and she has her lesbian partner, or she's giving her money. It's like,
yeah, is she like
a friend slash sex worker? It's not really.
Maybe she's her sugar mummy.
Well,
I bet she's a sugar mummy.
To Maud.
Well, she's also seeing a guy at the beginning.
Maud's sleeping with men. And so she could be bi as well, Amanda. But Maud's not gay. And she just didn't like that woman because, one, yes, she's jealous that. Well, she's not spending more time with Maud, but to her, what she's representing is she's not even a bigot per se. Oh, she's not even homophobic. In her mind, her job is to save her soul, and that this is the last moments of her life, and this is what she wants to concentrate on. And this woman is a distraction, and just like the other man was a distraction,
she just wants to get everyone away from her, whether it be man, woman, whatever. Get away from my Amanda. I love her, not you. I'm here to take
herself.
Care of her, not anybody else. That's crazy.
But I think it kind of builds into the the body horror element, and not so much in like a typical Cronenberg way, but in the sense that even with you know, Amanda's body, you know, she's sort of, it's shown, you know, she's sort of dying. There are kind of it makes a point of showing some of the damage the cancer has done to Amanda's body. The whole thing where she kind of puts nails on her, the soles of her feet, and you know, and the idea of, you know, the body being a sacred thing, but as well mixed with this, like, this Catholic idea of pain and sin, and
yeah.
But that's a very specific sect of Catholicism, very small, or like famous in the Da Vinci Code, the Opus Dei, where the mortification of the flesh, the albino guy is whipping his body, like,
to, but it's also, didn't you see this, forgive
their sins.
There's certain scenes where you see, like, Maud's actual body, like, in the flesh. She might be, like, wearing less clothes, but there's, like, signs of, like, self-harm where there's, like, massive slashes against her stomach and arms and stuff. And it's sort of, like, it's not even zoomed in on or anything like that, but it's sort of,
it's
like a
subtle
nod to, like, a history of, there must be a history of trauma and mental health and, you know, self-inflicted pain and not self-inflicted pain, sorry, self-harm and stuff like that. So it ties in with like the body horror.
Yeah, it's not exploitative.
She's just depicted as sort of like an outsider, an outcast, and who goes to look after another outsider and another outcast, like some American lady living in a random British seaside town, Scarborough.
One thing I did want to ask you guys about, what men in this film seem to be very like inactive or non-void, or at least used, you know, in that one sex scene. It's really not, it's anything but sexy.
I found that bit a bit unsettling to watch as well, because even though they're having consensual sex at that point,
and as she's leaving, he's like, oh, I remember you, you've slept with one of my friends before in a really grotesque way.
But it's a really horrible experience for her, because even though she's gone out to have her own good time and like drink or whatever, but like they're having sex and then they stop and she says no. And he just puts her head down and goes for it. And it's like, it essentially, you know, there's no consent there for him to do that. Mm. And he like, you can see the the discomfort in her face. And it was just really sad. And again, it's another, you know, woman, person being looked aside, not listened to, abused, like all of this stuff. There's like, she can't catch a break. Like, things just keep happening to her. And even though there's, some things are small, some things are big, they're taking such a toll on her because she's going through it completely alone. It's just sad. Poor Maud.
Poor Maud.
Basically, everyone be nice to each other, please. Everyone's just being a bit nice, so you don't know what's going on.
At the core of it, much like Vivarium yesterday, it does have like kind of a human heart.
Yeah.
Or at least some attempt to crawl back humanity. I think it is kind of, I mean, it's depressing and uncomfortable in a sense where, you know, there's a lot of dark shadow, you know, it's not really, ironically, the only light scene is at the end when she sets herself on fire. Everything else is very, you know, overcast, grey, kind of, again, from her point of view, very claustrophobic, very kind of like narrow tunnel vision. Though, did anyone find any humour in it?
Yes, my God, my favourite scene, I have to say this, because every time I had to like rewind it a few times, which made me cry so much. It's when Amanda's like, do you think I'm indecent? And then Maud just turns around and goes, no, you're lost. She goes, I think you're lost. She goes, no, you're just lost. And she said it with such conviction. She said it with such conviction.
The irony of that is that Maud is the one that's
the lost.
Exactly, yeah, Maud's the lost one. But it's the way she said it. It was like, no, I think you're lost. And it's just like, you know they're about to scrap then. You know she was going to hit her.
Mm-hmm.
Maud was angry. She knows Amanda's lost. She needs to be saved. But I thought that bit was funny. Even though wasn't meant to be.
Well, there was like definitely like a kind of like dry, like Maudan boomtish sense of humour to it. You know, even all the fact that, you know, Amanda is just chain smoking the entire time. I definitely a sardonic joke of dying, and that, you know, no matter what, you know, there's kind of a nihilistic tone to it. But it's not gleefully done, but
The hand job scene is also quite comical, the way that was done.
Yeah.
Wasn't even in the toilet, or just like in
the
corridor
of a room.
A corner of the pub. Yeah.
Anyone here got a hand job?
And then as he's leaving, he's like, well, okay, see ya. Thanks for that. That was nice.
Isn't it?
And he grabs his mate, he's like, let's go. Even he knew that was awkward.
That's mad.
We've all been.
Have we? Have you? Yeah. Have you been the tosser or the tossie? That's what I want to know.
The tosser or the tossie? Yeah. Now and then. Like, one hand, it was a tosser.
One hand was a tossie. What's going on here?
This is all pre-lockdown. There are certain pinpoints of like horror. Is that I found kind of the scene or two after it was then. Like a bit of humorous, really, almost like in bad example, but in Last House on the Left, there are these really weird scenes where you know, there's like these weird policemen intercutting scenes of people being disemboweled and raped and things. And while it's a really shoddy attempt to do, the idea is still there. You know, they kind of break up the horror with like just a little bit of like human.
But it was like what you were saying before, like her social interaction, she lacks almost.
She's socially almost, inept.
Not autistic, but she's socially inept.
But what I was going to say as well, but I never said earlier, this is irrelevant to the social stuff, but is that when the film first starts, you don't know what era it is until you see the light from Amanda's phone. And the entire film, Maud does not have a phone. Everybody else is on their phones, looking that's at their true, phones, talking, true. Texting. Socially interacting with each other, so it even it even furthers her isolation in this world. And it's the first phone. It's the first, and also like when the film starts, you're like, what era is this? Maud is speaking so proper, she's writing a letter. Yeah, it's all really like it's a bed sit.
She's lost in time, left behind. Well, even that, I thought, you know, the closest thing she came towards holy or saintly was putting her bed, like her bed sheet around her.
Oh yeah.
Maud needs a friend and a hug.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to say was like the experience of mental health and hallucinations and schizophrenia and the difference in the West and the East of the world is like in Western societies and countries where. Schizophrenia is seen as something demonic, anti-religion, like possession, all of that stuff. Most of these people that have these experiences will tend to have really dark ones, whereas like people say other parts of the world where if you're having a spiritual experience, you're like seen as a shaman or a guru or someone like that, and you're like, wow, you're so amazing that you get to speak to all these other entities, and it's seen in a much more positive light, whereas in Western society and Western religions, aka Christianity, especially with, you know, the witch trials and just everything that Christianity did to anything.
Well, even demonic possession, you know, kind of to schizophrenia, to being possessed by the devil.
Exactly. But it reminded me, even when she's dying at the last scene, I was just like, burning bush, fire, like all of that stuff, like all of these hallucinations that all of these religious figures had throughout time. Was it Saint Maud? Were all of them saints? Were they all of them outcasts? Like all of this stuff, it's just sort of. This is why this film is amazing, because it hits on so many different aspects of religion, society, like female experience, and all of that shit. Like, it's good.
All under. Also, I checked it last night. It's an hour and 25 minutes as well.
I love a film under 90 minutes.
And I think it's probably richer than. Most films over 2 hours, you know. It's a really strong debut feature. And it's actually...
Yeah, but there's no fat there's on it. No, you know, fat. There's no it's fat. Got, it's very, very well paced. Each moment, I'd say, is significant. And we slowly see her descent, really, she's... Not right at the start, obviously, but I think we just see a slow but gradual descent into complete madness, you know, through her. I think she's epileptic. I think it very much looks like she's having epileptic fits at the time, which is obviously going untreated. She clearly has mental health issues and PTSD. There's so much stuff happening.
But do you think she's descending to madness or ascending to heaven and godliness?
In her view, that's exactly what's happening. It's that juxtaposition. But this is clearly how she's seeing it. She's seeing herself, because after she has her epileptic fit, she then thinks, she sort of says, thank you, God, I am now. And after she hears, she has her fit and she hears God speak through the cockroach. Interesting, I found out when Googling, because I was trying to work out what language the cockroach and
no,
God
it's Welsh,
speaking.
Man.
Is it Welsh?
It's Welsh. And it's... And it's Moyford Clark. It is the lead actress voicing
Wow.
Godzilla. Again, clarifying that obviously this is all completely in her head.
But even at the end, when she goes to Amanda and she's got a bottle as if it's holy water. It was some sort
it's
of acid.
It's acid. Trying to burn her.
Madness.
Yeah, because it's like even the sound effects were going.
She was going to get away. You see what I mean? This film, there's so many layers to it.
I feel like I could watch it again now and pick up
on a hell of a lot more
things,
again, like we said, like with Vivarium yesterday, you know, there's a lot of, I think this one's actually a lot deeper, but yeah, it's again really accessible. You know, this could have easily, you know, if in the hands of, I don't know, Tarantino or even Jean-Luc Godard or something, this could have
ended man?
Up like
I'm joking.
Who's Jean-Luc, Tarantino or Godard?
Oh, it's just like both of them are men.
Oh, they are both men.
Yeah.
But you know, you could see these guys drawing this film out to, you know, 4.5 hours, being in black and white, taking it really, you know, seriously. And yet, you know, this new, fresh voice comes along and goes, to hell with all of that, hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's how you know you should fund the young people. This girl just came out being an usher
from
the Curzon.
She came straight out of film school. This was her idea, straight out of film school. And in 2016, she said Film 4 started funding her and BFI started funding her as well.
Mm.
So do you know what her
it's great. It's great
was?
For British film.
Do you know what her journey
I think
was from...
She came out of film school in 2014 and she said she already had an idea of the film.
Yeah.
Was developing it, and I think in 2016 the idea was greenlit by Film 4.
I think she
and
wrote it with
BFI.
A fellow usher as well.
Oh, fun.
Or she... Cool. This is why I love her story as well, because it reminds me of you and Paolo and Kozan. And like, we're just friends, just liking film, talking about it. One day you might write a screenplay. You don't know who might fund you. Something might happen.
Like next thing you know, Evil Dead.
She's LOL. Got a very promising future, definitely.
I'm very much looking forward to seeing what she does next, for sure.
Bong Joon-ho's listed her as his 20 upcoming favourite directors. Mark
what
Kermode.
Oh, really?
Mark Kermode said it was
Kermode
his favourite
movie.
Said it was his favourite film of the year. Danny Boyle gave it another.
Danny Boyle
great
liked
review.
It, yes.
LOL, Danny Boyle.
And it's a shame that COVID was happening. Like, it didn't have a big box office. Like, it definitely would have had a bigger one if circumstances were different.
I think it was only released outside of the UK, I think only in February. And I don't think it got a huge, I mean, it wouldn't have done, obviously, because of the pandemic. But I don't think it would have got a huge release anyway. You know, although it is A24, isn't it? I always forget A24 distributed it.
They didn't originally produce it. She made the film and they just
Yeah, A24 distributed in America, Studio Canal in the
That's
UK.
Why it's annoying, everyone trying to compare it to, like, Ari Aster or whatever, and Hereditary and all of that shit. She's like, bruv, it's
They're
not even an A24
movies.
Film. Leave her alone.
But A24, you have to give them credit. They are distributing
good, very
so
good.
Great
They're
horror
very
films
good.
Yeah, they
in
are.
America.
Yeah.
A24, The Witch? I know it was Midsommar and all that, but they do The Witch. Yeah.
Bond Ladybird, sorry, I hate Ladybird. I hate that.
I still haven't seen it. I still
don't
haven't
watch
seen
it. I hate Ladybird and I hate her. Greta Grund, whatever her name is, just stupid. Is that her name? I just white feminism. Just white feminist. White feminist film.
It really is a white feminist movie.
She's just, I hate her. Just, that's my opinion on that film and that. Sorry for any fans out there for her.
I saw about 20 minutes of it just for, like, Timothy Chalamet. I didn't really give a fuck about the film, really.
Timothy Chalamet. No, he's...
Shalamala.
Which I cannot wait. We're going off topic, but I can't wait for him in June.
Dude,
that's
Yeah.
Even though it's not horror, we might have to do an episode on it. It's just going to be a sick film.
Is there anything that we wanted to say about St. Maud? Anything else?
Go and watch
it. As you round up.
No, yeah, go watch it. It's on YouTube.
Buy it on DVD. That's what I bought it this week and watched it again a second time, and I'm very glad.
Love
it's available on all streaming platforms. It's available.
Oh, yeah. Not on Shudder. It's not on Shudder.
No, not yet. It's not a free subscription, but you can buy it on any streaming platform, rent or buy.
Renting is like £4. I should have just bought it. I did it last night and just rented it. But then you get it for 30 days.
So. There you go. Why don't you just borrow Ned's DVD, no?
You can borrow my DVD.
Or if anyone wants it, I can send you my Amazon details.
Ooh.
So how are we rating this film?
A 5. I'm going to give it a 5.
Yeah, I might.
I'm giving this film
I'm
a perfect
five,
yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
I would have given it a four, but five. How do we divide that? If we did three fives plus four, divide that by four. Who's good at maths?
I'm not 19, good at maths, man.
That's 19 divided 19, by
37, goddamn, 47.
Yeah. So
it's like 4.9 stars, right? If Roseanne's refusing to give it
9 stars divided by 4.
No, stick with your guns, Tyrone.
4.75, come on, that's almost 5. That's a great score.
Probably the highest rated film we've...
In a while.
I was going to say, you usually guys end up all giving it a sort of a 4, or it always averages out as nearly a 4.
Yeah, it does.
Apart from Inferno, and that gets a 5. Yeah, that was a high-rated film. Yeah, you should, go watch it. Mm-hmm. You know, and considering, you know, we've spent nigh on almost an hour trying to break it down, there's a lot to it, and it definitely, I think, requires repeat viewings. You know, like any Bergman film or...
Any of the best,
or,
any of the best
you know,
films.
Irreversible or something. You know, somewhere there's the more you see, the better the film will become.
Mm.
Wonderful.
I almost feel bad for giving it a 4 now.
In it, Hayden. Why are you hating?
You can.
I'll give it. Let's just give it a 5. Let's give it a 5 all round.
Five skulls.
You caved.
I caved. But thanks so much for joining us, Ned.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a privilege. I would love to come on again sometime.
I'd
love to have you back.
Awesome. Yes. Yes. Thank you very much. It was good to chat to fellow horror fans always.
Yeah. Well,
thanks for listening.
Hope you enjoy the episode. Bye, St. Maud.
Bye, St. Maud. XOXO Gossip Girl.
R.I.P.
R.I.P.
Rest in heaven.
Beautiful. Till next time.
Abbott Era. Deal comes, but must be called. Comes to all the sleeping hold. Breaks the night and lifts the drawer. Deep calm, but must be called. The demon calls to me at night. Demon has no other strength except to rest. Stretching thighs, those who spend is to die. The demon has but one mistake, he lingers when he should not stay. He should not stay but rather go. The demon has no soul as such. His breath is cold as winter's touch. His hair the blackness of the night. The demon offers up his life. The demon is not life we know. He lives but is the nevermore. His eyes are of the blackest coal. The demon has no soul. Many are the demon's face, and many are the forms he takes. Beware that you don't prejudice.